a substitute hosting for the Atlas Society's CEO, Jennifer Grossman. I'm glad to be back with TAS senior scholar Rob Trzynski discussing The Road from Etch-a-Sketchistan. And after Rob's take, we'll open it up to questions on the subject. So if any of you would like to participate, I encourage you to raise your hands through the app and we'll bring you up to be part of the discussion. The session is being recorded for educational purposes. Rob, thank you for being here today. You know, we've done these a couple of times now, and I noticed that you kind of have a twist on some of your titles. So beyond the obvious, what is Etch-a-Sketchistan? I noticed that it's The Road From. So I'm wondering if that means that we're in Etch-a-Sketchistan.
Right, right. So thanks, Scott. Yeah, this title is sort of a play both on the old, was it Bing Crosby, Bob Hope road movies, you know, The Road to such and such. And that and an old joke from The Onion. So The Onion, you know, is a satirical newspaper. They do these sort of one-line headline gags. And one of their gags once was something like Earthquake wipes out Etch-a-Sketchistan. You know, there's no article to it. It's just a headline, right? And, you know, the idea that you take an Etch-a-Sketch and you shake it upside down and everything disappears. Well, I picked that up some years ago as an analogy for what I saw happening about 8 to 10 years ago. And that is that after sort of the passing away of, after the war in Iraq, as we got into the Obama administration, there were a number of these cases. Like there was a time when Obama wanted a congressional authorization to do something in Syria. And you had this weird experience where the Democrats were using all the pro-war arguments that the Republicans had been using 3 years earlier. And the Republicans were using all the anti-war arguments that the Democrats were using 3 years earlier. And it's one of these things that happens ever so often in politics where everybody just totally switches sides and adopts the exact opposite arguments just to make things interesting. I called that period Etch-a-Sketchistan because the way I view it is it's like somebody had taken the foreign policy debates of the previous decades and taken it all and turned it upside down and shaken it. And we're all starting from a new slate, a blank slate on our Etch-a-Sketch. And so it led me to sort of say, well, we need to rethink these things through and decide, what should we be doing? Because, you know, for many decades during the Cold War, and then it sort of got transferred over onto the war on terror, there have been sort of established predictable schools of foreign policy that were generally associated with the two different parties. You had your realists, you had your internationalists, you had your sort of, and you had your blame America first leftists who were always, you know, we were always the bad guys in the Cold War. We were always to blame for everything. And you had your Cold War hawks, and you had this sort of, you know, a set of expected positions that people would take, which, as I said, were sort of transferred over, you know, after the holiday from history of the 1990s, they were sort of transferred over onto the war on terrorism. But by about 8 to 10 years ago, that was all getting shaken up and lost. And I think the result is not just that we had no predictable schools of strategy, but that we had sort of no schools of strategy. It became unpredictable. I think that's accelerated even more so after the rise of Donald Trump, who was not, you know, carrying on any of the existing, you know, neoconservative or internationalist or hawkish. He wasn't carrying on any of the existing schools of foreign policy. It became much more that there is no accepted schools of foreign policy. No accepted views on grand strategy. And I want to just take a second to explain what I mean by grand strategy, because it's a term that's used sort of in the foreign policy world, but not really understood outside of that. And grand strategy means basically your highest level strategy. The strategy that you have for your country's approach to the entire world in terms of what objectives you want to achieve, and then integrating all the different tools that you have as a country, you know, the economic tools, the cultural, the military, sanctions and international institutions, all of the different tools you have, you're trying to integrate all those together to show how they're all going to work together to achieve a set of goals that you have for the country. And I think we just simply don't have a grand strategy as a nation. I don't think we even have a couple of leading contenders, you know, competitors for what would be a grand strategy. I think we have no grand strategy at all. We're sort of acting very reactively in our foreign policy right now, that when there's a crisis, we'll sort of, you know, reluctantly pay some attention to it. And people will sort of fall out on that depending on where the politics of the moment takes them. But nobody has a real overarching view of here's America's place in the world. Here are our objectives. Here's how we're going to achieve them. And I think that's true to some extent to both sides. I think both in practice, both the sides have become, for lack of a better word, isolationist. And I say for lack of a better word, because of course, you know, there's a whole history. Ayn Rand thought the term isolationist was a smear used against some of the people from, you know, the 30s and 40s. Although I what I've observed is it's sometimes almost as if people looked at the term isolationist, and you know, there's a tendency people have in politics to live down to the worst caricature that the other side comes up with for them, right? So, you know, if the other side calls you a bad thing enough times, you say, fine, I'm going to be that bad thing. And to some extent, I think both sides have become somewhat quote-unquote isolationist in the sense that they are, now, to put it in more accurate terms, they've become reflexively anti-interventionist. And what I've noticed is that sometimes in practice, there's not a lot of difference between a lot of difference between America first and blame America first, right? So the left has its view of America should stay within its borders and not do anything. And that's the sort of view that, well, America is a force for evil in the world. Every time we intervene, we just cause trouble. We're imperialists, we're aggressors. Therefore, we should stay within our own borders and let things sort themselves out in the rest of the world without us getting involved. Now, on the right, you have the sort of America first idea, which is that It generally tends to come with a heavy dose of pessimism about our current state of the United States and say, oh, we have so many problems here. We're economically in decline. We're culturally in decline. We should therefore focus on our domestic problems entirely and not try to waste effort on all the, you know, on these. Why should we waste our military effort and our blood and treasure on these foreigners out there who don't deserve our help? And it tends to also come, I think, well, we'll get later on, it also tends to come from religious conservatives who see allies in some of the authoritarian enemies that we have. But I think the common thread, really, beyond all of that, the common thread is there seems to be a general desire not to think about foreign policy. And this is a commonality in America. You know, America is a large, wealthy, powerful nation surrounded by oceans. With no, you know, immediate danger from our immediate neighbors, and so there's a tendency to, you know, sort of view the rest of the world as being out there somewhere and not very close to us. The default American view on foreign policy is that we don't want to have to think about it for the average person, and I think we've sort of relapsed into that in a sort of a sullen and determined way. And so we either don't think about what's going on in foreign policy, or we sort of filter it through our domestic politics, right? So if that was what I noticed about this thing with Syria, you know, if Barack Obama wants to do anything in Syria, something in Syria against the Assad regime, then we're against it. And it doesn't really matter what it is he wants to do, because he wants to do it, we're now against it. Or because my guy wants, you know, or because the Republicans are for something, then we're against it. That's the Democrats are against it. So we tend to filter it through our domestic politics without really thinking about foreign policy. So my goal, that's what the road from Etch-a-Sketchistan really refers to. It means that we need to, you know, we've shaken the Etch-a-Sketch. There's no real established schools of foreign policy. So that gives us an opportunity at a time to start over from basic principles and work back towards asking the question of, well, what should the foreign policy of a free society be? What should American foreign policy be? And to try to sort of build that up in the absence of anybody having a really distinct school on that. And of course, you know, as recent events in the news, this whole thing in Ukraine shows that, you know, we're not going to be given the option of not having a view on this. You know, the crises are going to come and press in upon us. We need to know what we're doing in response to that. So the two things, just to wrap up my time, the two things I want to suggest as places to start from is, first of all, I want to take one thing that I think the America First types tend to rely on, which is yes, we should act in our national self-interest, in America's national self-interest. But we have to define what that self-interest is. And I think the sort of the America First types, or especially the Trump administration, I think tended to have a very mercantilist view of America's national interest, that our America's national interest was that the other guys are getting the better of us on trade. And so we should try to manage trade and have the president be a deal maker in chief who restricts trade there and makes deals over here. And is this purely sort of transactional and economic idea that, you know, if anybody else in the world is winning economically, then we must be losing. So therefore, you know, it's sort of a return to this old mercantilist viewpoint that trade has to be managed by the government in a way that benefits us and is not good for anybody else. And it's a very narrow and economically wrong approach to it. And I also want to point out that America First in that version also often tends, in the sort of anti-interventionist version, often tends to actually mean America last, because the more you say America is not going to, outside of managing trade, America is not going to intervene in the world, what you really mean is everybody else gets the initiative. The Chinese get to take the initiative. The Russians get to take the initiative and try to redraw the map of Europe. And, you know, and we're going to be, if we're not intervening, if we're not actively involved in those things, then what it means is that America is the last country to weigh in on what's going on in the world. So I think this, my vision of national self-interest, sort of to tie it back to the discussion we had here on Clubhouse a couple of weeks ago, it ties into the idea of enlightened self-interest. So this is enlightened national self-interest. And that is the idea that America's interest isn't just something narrow, like we should win in trade deals, or something narrow like, oh, we're paying too much for NATO and we should make the Europeans pay more. They should pay more, by the way. But that's, you know, that should be the center of our foreign policy is very off. Instead, it should be America is pursuing its self-interest, and its self-interest lies in strengthening other free nations around the world and keeping authoritarian regimes and dictatorships, keeping them sort of at bay and contained and weak and on the defensive. So it should mean, so the enlightened enlightened American self-interest should be that we have an interest in various alliances and in cooperation with various different countries, and especially in expanding trade with other free nations. But that's a larger expanded concept of our self-interest, because the idea is the stronger all the other free nations are, the more the people who share our values and our political system, the stronger and more numerous they are, then the safer we're going to be, and the more hospitable, the better place the world is going to be for our trade and growth and influence. Now, the second part about that is when you get to this issue of, you know, I said that you have the blame America First and you have the America First people. And I think the answer to that is what we should want is not America as the world's servant or the world's policeman necessarily. So America not as the world's servant, but also America not as ignoring the world, but I would say America as the world's leader. So we should go back to the idea of America as being the leader of the free world. And that's the role we should look for in the world, is that we are the leader of other like-minded nations. So the idea is we're not their servant. We're the ones sort of setting the agenda and making and taking a leading role to make sure things go in ways that suit our interests. But that we do have to, you know, invest in the time and effort and some of the economic cost and the military power that is required to have America be a leader rather than a follower, or rather than, was it Obama's idea of leading from behind, which is just another way of saying we're going to be a follower. And the reason why the main reason why I argue for this, and this comes from, really ties into the recent events, what's going on in Ukraine, is the fact that, again, the issue is if America is not a leader in the world, then you create a vacuum that will be filled by somebody else. And right now, there's a lot of sort of strident and expansive authoritarian systems that are trying to fill that gulf, that gap. And if we don't lead, they will. And you see that, I think, with what's going on in Ukraine. Now, hopefully, I just saw some, you know, the news today says that that Putin has withdrawn some troops from the Ukrainian border. So it looks like this giant buildup around Ukraine was a bluff rather than an actual invasion. But it's also clear that, you know, why was he building up troops around Ukraine? There was no threat to Russia from Ukraine. You know, Ukraine does not have the wherewithal or ability to invade Russia. There, you know, very little of Russia's border is with NATO or NATO-allied countries. The threat of invasion or attack on Russia is totally imagined, you know, from these paranoiacs in the Kremlin. But really what it comes from is that he has the need to control more and more things around Russia. And I think specifically he saw and still sees Ukraine as a threat because Ukraine is full of a bunch of people who speak Russian. And I just talked with an objectivist who's from Belarus, you know, who grew up under Soviet rule in Belarus and fled Belarus recently for Ukraine. And the thing is, it's very easy for a lot of these dissidents from Russia and Ukraine, or from Russia and Belarus and places like that, to end up in Ukraine where they can, you know, speak Russian, they can have an influence and an impact in Russia. So, you know, the dictatorships are driven to want to expand outside their borders because they see anything outside of their borders as a place where dissent and alternative models of government can be displayed that is a threat to their rule. So I think that's why, you know, the dictatorships will always want to fill in all the gaps and expand and assert their control wherever we don't. And that's why we have to take that position of global leadership. So that's how I want to, in very, very broadest terms, that's what I want to say. And then we can take the discussion from there and talk about what would that mean in specifics.
Great. Well, I want to encourage people that want to be part of the discussion to raise your hand and through the app, and we'll bring you up on stage. Rob, I have a question. You know, some of this is just about basic unity. And, you know, whether it's, I mean, getting Democrats and Republicans on the same page in foreign policy, not to mention even with something like Ukraine, where, you know, the Germans, they wouldn't even send any kind of military equipment to Ukraine. So, I mean, we have to all be on the same page before we can even, you know, talk about what it is we're pushing for.
Well, yeah, I think that's why American leadership, though, is so important, because, you know, the Germans on their own. So the background for this is the Germans, this is really one of the things we have to, a sort of what seems like a domestic issue, but one with strong, turns out to have very strong foreign policy implications, is the Germans adopted this policy, and I can't pronounce the German word for it, but there's this policy of basically going for a massive investment in quote unquote alternative energy. But that also includes, because, you know, supposedly because of global warming, but it also included shutting down all their nuclear power plants, right? So if you were concerned about global warming, you'd want to build more nuclear power plants. But they have this sort of insane green agenda where it's like everything, all power plants have to be shut down, and we're going to have wind and solar. And in practice, what that meant is they shut down their nuclear plants, they shut down their coal plants. And because solar, you know, solar and wind power isn't actually reliable, they become extremely dependent on natural gas. Now, we've done that in the U.S. too. We've become vastly increased the share of our energy generated by natural gas. But we have fracking, and we have this vast supply of natural gas at much less expensive prices than the Germans could get them. For the Germans, that meant if your economy is entirely dependent on natural gas, that means you're dependent on Russia. You're dependent on these Russian pipelines pumping natural gas. And that basically has Finlandized Germany. It has made them unable to oppose Russia because they're terrified that Russia is going to cut off their gas supplies. So that's something that a domestic issue that they sort of shot themselves in the foot. But here's where American leadership comes in. You have to, you know, have America basically being the power that comes to the Germans and says, look, this is what you have to do, argues with them, browbeats them, and offers them, like, you know, hey, we've got plenty of natural gas. Let's set up, you know, giant terminals for, let's go into this giant effort. You know, if you want to have, this is one area of mercantilism I would agree with, which is, you know, put a massive effort into making Germany dependent on American natural gas. We've got huge supplies of it. But of course, again, domestically, Biden would have to be in, come out in favor of fracking. Might help him get reelected in Pennsylvania, but you know, it's something that he'd have to oppose the Greens, and he's not likely to do that. But again, it's the idea, if America is a leader in the world, it can start to sort of say to other nations, this is the direction we need to go. I'm starting to kind of remember, so David French recently stole a headline. Well, I say he stole a headline from me. I used it first. It's been hanging out there for a while. In the 2012 elections, they had these debates with Obama versus Romney, and Romney said, this is way back in 2012, you know, that Russia is one of our top foreign adversaries. And, you know, Obama scoffed at that idea and said, well, the 1980s called, they want their foreign policy right. back. And so I wrote an article very shortly after that saying, the 1980s are calling, do we want their foreign policy back? Saying that, you know, against Russia and against China, we need to adopt certain things that Reagan did in the 80s. And David French wrote something about that recently, and I think there's a lot to that. And one of the things in the 80s is that there was this alliance that where Reagan and Thatcher worked together to sort of keep the Europeans, the Western Europeans on board, keep them on target, and sort of browbeat them and cajole them and do this very intensive diplomacy with the Europeans to try to keep them all on a single strategy against the Russians. Because on their own, they'll just sort of scatter, you know, they're sort of scatter willy-nilly and, you know, go wherever. So that's the sort of leadership that you need that, but it requires a president who's engaged and who cares about it and who has a very clear idea of what he wants to accomplish. Reagan had that, but you know, we haven't had anybody, I think, who had. George W. Bush had a very clear concept of what he wanted to do. You could argue about whether he had the right one. He did have a very clear concept. Since then, nobody's had a clear concept of what they want to accomplish.
All right. That's good. Lawrence, do you want to add to the conversation?
Sure. Am I coming through pretty clear?
Yes.
Great. So, Rob, I'm a little skeptical of this notion. I would want to hope you can try and clarify it a little bit for me.
Sure.
Because the statement, I wasn't around, of course, but it kind of gives me the feeling sort of like, you know, 1947, you know, we need to make the world safe for democracy with the Truman Doctrine, sort of countering communism wherever it sprouts its head. And while we don't want more communists in the world, I guess with the reasonable explanation of the time, the result were these getting the United States mired in these very complicated entanglements and ultimately in things that cost, you know, American lives and might not necessarily have been fruitful. It's kind of hard to see what would have happened if you weren't there or what were the consequences of places like Vietnam helping prop up a government and trying to show them the right way. But it ultimately resulted in, you know, dealing with less than probably ideal partners, hoping to counter the greater evil, so to speak. They're not actually emulating, but you're more treating them like children, hoping that they'll follow along in this right example, but they don't do it. And that's what I see a little bit in Europe, in they've made these policies for themselves, elected to do these things with their plants, and now it's made them dependent on Russia, which is bad. But making them dependent on us is, I guess, also kind of iffy in my mind. It's sort of like a mixture of sort of like American imperialism, and I don't want to use that word because there's so the connotations around it, but it makes me a little bit skeptical if this is the right way forward. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Okay, so yeah, I do want to say though, you know, for all the scorn we heap on the Germans, I think the Germans are not our number one problem with regard to Russia. The center of gravity of that is going to be a little farther east, which is one of the great luxuries we have because of the Cold War. Is that, you know, the line between Russia and Russian influence and Western Europe is not, you know, going through the middle of Germany. It's now, you know, hundreds of miles east of that. You know, it's going to be what we do with Poland and what we do with, you know, Poland and the Czech Republic and Ukraine and those and the Baltic states. Those are going to be the key areas, and those people have their heads on a little straighter with regard to the Russian threat because they're a lot closer to it, and they have a whole history of Russian occupation. But you know, I do remember these complaints from back in the Cold War. I remember complaints about the Europeans, the Western Europeans. Everybody look up. There's an old song by who's the guy? He did music for Toy Story and
Randy Newman.
Yes, Randy Newman did a song called "Political Science," and it starts, "The whole world hates us. Heaven knows why." And says, you know, we give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful. And he ends up by advocating that, you know, it's a satirical song advocating we use nuclear weapons against the entire rest of the world. it was the lyrics come from the sense that, you know, here we are helping all these other people and all they ever do is badmouth us. And that was definitely true of the Western Europeans. But on the one hand, to some extent, you have to ask, you know, that's why I think the importance of having the idea of a grand strategy is that you set what your goals are in the world. And that kind of supersedes the question of, well, is this particular ally that I have to achieve those goals, does he have bad things about him? You know, so in the Cold War, there were two things. You had the ungrateful, you know, the two things that were galling were first of all, the ungrateful allies. You know, the French and the Germans and that sort of thing. So you had the ungrateful allies, and then you had the quote unquote friendly dictators. That oftentimes we would support a regime that was itself a dictatorship in order to prevent what we saw as a worse dictatorship from arising. You know, so for example, in Vietnam, you know, the alternative wasn't we support a somewhat corrupt and oppressive regime in South Vietnam versus we leave them and they find their own way. It was, we support them or else they become another province of the Soviet Empire. So, you know, it wasn't that the alternative to us, you know, and that's something that I think a big lesson from the post-World War II era, when the British gave up their empire, right? So the idea is, okay, we're no longer going to have the British Empire controlling all these places. And in a lot of cases, what happened is, well, another dictator came in. And in some of those cases, it was they became part of the Soviet Empire. So you were just treating one, you know, you weren't, it wasn't imperialism versus non-imperialism. It was one empire versus another. So I do think that sometimes the necessity of supporting friendly dictators was exaggerated. And one of the things we did in the 80s that people don't realize and don't appreciate is that after initially sort of backing the friendly dictator strategy, and when he first came into office, the Reagan administration actually turned against that eventually, and they did a lot of work in places like the Philippines and El Salvador in trying to basically push for reform of what had been authoritarian regimes that were our allies, to push them towards having a freer society and having elections and free elections and that sort of thing. And so you saw, you know, the South Korea began as a military dictatorship, became a democracy. Again, for lack of a better word, democracy. Same thing with some of our other allies. I'm trying to think of what's the other example I had. Say Taiwan is another great example where, you know, it was Chiang Kai-shek and his nationalists, you know, settled in Taiwan when they lost the mainland and they had what was an authoritarian system, which again, by the 1980s became a free society. So the idea was to ally ourselves sometimes with less than free societies, but then push them to become freer. An example that'd be more relevant to Latin America would be Chile, right? So you support Pinochet, but then you push for and welcome him, then eventually leaving, you know, giving up power and having elections and becoming a free society. So, you know, there's a lot of arguments to be made about what the terms of those are, but I think the main thing that I want to push is you decide what your big foreign policy objectives are. And then sometimes if you have to work with an unsavory ally because the alternative is worse, you do it, but then you're always working for how can I improve, find a better means to do this without having to make that compromise. Or if you sometimes have to work with an ungrateful ally, but that's, you know, it's better to have the French saying bad things about us than to have the French be under the control of Moscow, right? So sometimes you can't let the, as much as you might, you know, be annoyed by your allies, you can't let that annoyance overcome the fact that it's still better to work with them than it is to let the other guy have his way. And that's the power of having a grand strategy, having an idea of this is what we want to accomplish in the world, is it keeps you from getting sidetracked. It helps you make the priorities of when is, you know, what's the lesser, what's the greater consideration and what's the lesser consideration. And of course, we're always going to argue over what those are.
Good. Well, Alan, thank you again for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, and Rob, I'd point out the French are going to say bad things about the United States, no matter what. So that's just a general principle. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the Middle East. I agree with your idea that America needs, or principle, America needs to be a leader in the world. And I'm just wondering, because when I look at our policy in the Middle East starting from 2016, it just seems to me that the United States has just simply given it up.
Yes.
And for the life of me, I really can't justify it in my mind, especially when you consider something like that. I mean, we have something like 40 or 50,000 soldiers in South Korea for the last 50 years. And in Afghanistan, we had 3,000, I think, that was being used to maintain it. So in terms of military costs, to maintain that country and to keep it where, and to keep it as an ally and, quote, spreading democracy or freedom, it just, the idea of giving it up just seemed, there was no rhyme or reason to it, unless you want to say, you know, well, there are other forces, which I think there are, but I'm curious about your.
Yeah, I didn't hear the last word, but I think I know what where you're going.
I'm curious to your thoughts about. Okay. In general, our policy in the Middle East, and you know, whether we did the right thing or no, or
the Middle East is a great example. I think it's one of the leading examples today of one of those areas where there aren't a lot of really great enthusiastic options. I mean, Latin America was a little bit like that, you know, 50 years ago, where you basically had or Southeast Asia, where you basically generally had. I think Gene Kirkpatrick, who was one of the officials in the Reagan administration early on, was famous for making this distinction between authoritarians and totalitarians. And basically, that was your option in a lot of these places. You could support the authoritarians to keep out the totalitarians, being communists. And the Middle East is a great example where, you know, there's only one real free country in the Middle East, and that's Israel. That's why we remain one of their staunchest allies. But other than that, you know, outside of Israel, you are dealing with which monarch or which strongman do you want to ally with against which, you know, which other against which other competing dictatorship, and that presents us with some really unsavory options. But I also think that last summer's withdrawal from Afghanistan gives us an indication of why it is you don't just say, throw up your hands and say, oh, well, forget about it. Let's let this all fall apart. It's too far away. It's not related to us enough. Let's not care about it. Because for one thing, I think, you know, what Putin was doing with Ukraine recently, some of the rhetoric that's coming out of China about Taiwan, about how they're going to reinvade Taiwan, a lot of that is testing the waters to say, look, if America isn't going to, you know, support its allies, if it's not going to even attempt to shape the world the way it wants to be the way it wants to be, then maybe we can get away with a lot. Maybe we can take Taiwan and they won't lift a finger. Maybe we can take Ukraine and they won't lift a finger. And I think there was this. I saw a lot of warning signs about that. So, for example, the Biden administration tried to boast about how, well, actually, you know, the real story in Afghanistan is this historic airlift that we did to get all these people out of Afghanistan. And it's like they wanted to boast about how the triumph of their foreign policy would be a series of retreats in which they evacuate American citizens from various one place of the world after another. And I saw echoes of that when they started making plans for, oh, we have troops on standby to help evacuate Americans from Ukraine. So it's like you can't have a foreign policy that consists of we will keep our military on standby to evacuate our people whenever a dictatorship invades somewhere or whenever a group of fanatics takes over. Now, I think the problem with Afghanistan, I think Afghanistan actually is a great example, though, of this fact that we ended up with no foreign policy at all. So we ended up what I saw in Afghanistan and looking at the people who look at the military strategy and tactics and all that, is that we never really used a proper counterinsurgency strategy there. But we also never, it's like we wouldn't withdraw and we wouldn't do what was necessary to win. And I think what happened under both Obama and Trump was that neither one really wanted to commit to doing what was necessary to win in Afghanistan or to have a successful outcome in Afghanistan. But at the same time, neither one wanted to withdraw because it would be politically unpopular. And so what they ended up doing was just sort of, you know, you keep a couple thousand troops in there who are sort of kind of doing something, but never really, you know, we don't really have a strategy that we're following through and giving our full effort to. And you just limp along for decades. And Biden just ended up being the guy who was foolish enough to think that go ahead and think that it wouldn't be a political disaster for him to finally withdraw our troops. So I think, you know, that comes from this sort of drift that we're in, where I think that there was basically what happened is we rejected the George W. Bush era strategy that said, no, we have to adopt a proper counterinsurgency strategy and we have to put in the resources necessary to win the war on terror. We rejected that, but we never put anything new as a grand strategy in place. And so there was no concept of what are we doing here? We were lingering around in Afghanistan to avoid making, you know, keeping 3,000 troops or 10,000 troops there, basically to avoid making a decision, to avoid the president having to make a decision. And so that's a symptom of this kind of drift that we've had in our foreign policy for the last, you know, 10 years or so.
I think I remember Trump at some point saying the generals told him that he could win, but he'd have to kill a million people and he didn't want to do that.
I don't believe the generals actually told him that, but yeah, that's sort of symptomatic of the whole thing. You know, I could win, but, and then the butts come in, and then, you know, but he didn't want to, but at the same time, he didn't want to withdraw because that would have been politically unpopular. So, you know, we end up just lingering.
Right. It just reminds me of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. You're talking about brave Sir Robin, you know, bravely runs away. That's the U.S. foreign policy.
Yes. When danger reared its ugly head, he bravely turned his tail and fled. That's sort of our policy right now. We're bravely turn our tail and flee.
Well, Roger, I want to bring you in here for this. Thank you for joining us. Well, Roger may actually be unavailable at the moment. So while he's getting ready, we'll go to Bill.
All right. My thought on listening to all of this is, what makes anyone think we have a nation that is capable of following the advice that is being offered here or anywhere else? My observation has been that none of our recent presidents have been capable of forming a coherent plan for much of anything. And I'm not even going to include Bush in that. He seemed to have a quote plan, unquote, which basically amounted to throw your weight around and see what breaks. And a lot of things broke, but I do not think we actually accomplished any of our end goals. So what is what's the point of arguing what should America do when we do not have leaders, we do not have a polity that is capable of actually coming to any sort of division. While we're divided up into red team, blue team, tribal politics, we are not going anywhere.
All right. So my answer to that, I think it's a good question, but my answer, because, you know, oftentimes I will, you know, so one of the, my pet peeves is oftentimes you'll come up with, and there's some objectivist occasion who I argued with this, where they come up with these, you know, amazingly uber hawkish things of, oh, we should drop nuclear weapons and we should do this. And they have these incredibly hawkish plans for how they're going to totally reshape the Middle East and we're going to, you know, invade Iran and et cetera. And I was sort of thinking, you know, as much as I would like to topple the Iranian regime, you know, on the one hand, a country that was capable, you know, if America was actually capable of taking the extraordinary dramatic actions that you're proposing, we would never have been in this situation in the first place. You know, the whole world would have been, you know, if we were in the position to do that, we would have done things 20 years ago that would have made the world vastly different than it is now. So you're asking for too much. So I think that's a legitimate criticism. But I would also say, though, that some of the things you just said, I could have said exactly the same thing. Well, I would have been 10 years old, but I could have said exactly the same things in 1979. You could have come along in 1979 with Jimmy Carter in the office. And before that was Ford. And before that was Nixon, who was, you know, the big champion of detente with the Soviet Union. And, you know, we basically had, and before that was, you know, the blunderings of Johnson. And you could go back to, you know, you had, you know, at least since Eisenhower, and there's some criticisms you can make of Eisenhower, but at least since Eisenhower, since 1960 to 1979, there was like 20 years of bumbling, directionless foreign policy. And then, but, you know, you could still get a Ronald Reagan. Now, even Reagan, though, I mean, you know, we sort of look back, you know, I think especially if there was a period there where there was sort of the, I called him St. Ronald of Reagan. There was this sort of gauzy hagiography that was done of Ronald Reagan as being the great leader, especially if you are on the right. And, you know, Reagan is remembered as being better than he was. But Reagan was an example of how, you know, we did like maybe a third of what we really should have done to oppose the Soviets, and they collapsed. And that's the thing I think we can't lose sight of. We're in a very pessimistic moment right now where everybody is sort of looking, you know, on the right and the left. We both view America as being in decline and in a funk and being weak and being divided, et cetera. And that's what really sort of reminds me of the 1970s. I think we're going through a mini rehearsal of the 1970s, you know, complete with crime and inflation and you know, all we need is disco now and it'll all be complete. We have that's that same sort of inward looking funk of thinking, oh, we're so weak and we can't do anything. And then, you know, in the 80s, what happened is we came and we did actually astonishingly little compared to what we could have done and achieved this enormous breakthrough in terms of making the world a much, much better place in many different ways with, you know, the rollback of communism. So that's what I see today, because, you know, I was talking to somebody from Ukraine recently, and he's talking about how the idea that Russia is some great power, you know, they want to project themselves as a great power, but they've got an economy that's like the size of Denmark. You know, they've got it's this tiny, hollow little shell of a country, reduced. They have the lower population they used to have. They've got a very weak little economy. The idea that they're a great power and are going to be a great European empire is this incredibly toxic and destructive fantasy that the Russians are entertaining right now. So, you know, the idea that that there'd be a contest between Russia and the United States is ridiculous. And if we just put forth 1/10 of our strength, we'd put the Russians in their place. But, and that's why I'm sort of arguing against, you know, on the deepest level, arguing against, we have to get out of this funk of thinking that there's nothing we can do and that we shouldn't, you know, that we can't be a leader in the world.
I got 2 points to make about that. First, I don't think the 80s are comparable today because the divisiveness and the decrease in rationality over the last, you know, however many decades, I was there, so I kind of know. those are a real change. But the second point I want to make is that you're correct. The Soviet Union and today's Russia are incredibly weak, given, you know, their potential.
And Russia's weaker than the Soviets ever were because they're
smaller. That's correct. So my point is that what Reagan basically did, when you strip away everything, all the noise and all the nonsense, what Reagan basically did was he let the Soviet Union do what it inevitably had to do, which was fall apart. Okay. And I think that that more than anything else is the proper strategy for today. It's not confront them militarily. It's let them take what they want and let them choke on it. Because that's what they'll do.
Well, I don't think we let them take what they want, because you're one of the things that what I think he did is he, if you want to talk about what Reagan did in the 80s, there were a couple of key things. One is he actually did a massive military buildup. It was begun by the Republican Congress, or by a bipartisan Congress slightly before him. But he did a massive military buildup, and specifically a military buildup in high technology. Well, not just that, but we had, I remember reading there's a great book you should read sometime called Big Pilot. And it was written by a guy, Belenko, I think is his name, who was a MiG pilot who defected to the West and took his MiG with him, took his, you know, shiny new MiG 25 or whatever, the latest model of MiG. He took it with him, landed in Japan. We got, you know, we had to return it to the Russians, but we returned it in crates after dismantling it and analyzing it. But he wrote about how what it was like for a Russian fighter pilot when I think it was the F-14 came out, and they were, you know, and the Russian analysts were describing to the MiG pilots the capabilities of the F-14, and they're looking at each other, you know, aghast at the fact they're going to have to fight this plane, and they ask him, well, how do we defend against this? And he says, there is no known defense, practical or theoretical. And that's the answer they get. So we were at this point, you know, even in the late 70s, where our technology was leapfrogging the Russians so much that they couldn't possibly keep up with it. And that was part of what, and I also remember in 1991, during the Gulf War. The Gulf War was basically it was one of these proxy wars where you have our military and our allies' militaries who are trained and equipped by us go up against a military that's trained and equipped by the Russians, and we see how they do. And I remember there being a story about the report carried back to Moscow from the Russian military observers in Iraq, who were basically saying, we were utterly helpless. There was nothing we could do. The American military just rolled over, you know, all the tanks, all the airplanes we had, they just rolled over us. And that had a huge impact back to Moscow and was, I think, largely, you know, had a measurable effect on the later collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, that happened within a year of that, is that they realized, you know, we have no defense against the Americans in any kind of conventional conflict, and so it helped in that process of demoralizing the Russians. So I think that, you know, that there are a lot of very substantial things we do in terms of military buildup, in terms of support for dissidents in Poland, in terms of the rhetoric, we focus a lot on the military stuff because, you know, that's it's foreign policy. It's about war, but it's not just about war. It's about the military. It's about the use of the military, not in actually fighting, but in deterring the enemy. But it's also about trade, and it's about ideology, and it's about culture, and it's about all the different, you know, there's this whole vast suite of different techniques and tools that you have at your disposal and it's about diplomacy with, you know, getting your allies all on board on a united front. There's this huge range of tech tools you have at your disposal, most of which do not involve war or the military, that you can use to put pressure on and to prevent your enemy from making advances. And that's what we need to, you know, when you get back on to doing a lot of that. And right now, but to do that, you have to have a direction. You have to know what you want to do and why you want to do it. And you can't be in this sort of directionless funk that we are currently in.
Yeah. And if I could just jump in, Bill, I mean, I was there too in the 80s. And while there wasn't the social media there is today, I remember it being pretty contentious too, in terms of the division. I mean, every time Reagan said something that we now remember as him being, say, assertive or strong, that the media would jump all over that too. So I think it was, we had, that division was there even then, I would argue, but.
Let me throw in something that I have an acquaintance, somebody just a few years older than me, who I happen to know through, so basically through my kid's school. He's a fairly prominent person in foreign policy, sort of academic foreign policy stuff. And talked about, I had a conversation, we talked about the reason he went into that field was that in the early 80s, he thought Reagan was going to cause a nuclear war and destroy the entire world. And that's why he wanted to go into foreign policy, to prevent Ronald Reagan from causing, you know, from this belligerent madman, Ronald Reagan, from destroying the world. And I didn't have the heart to ask him, so when did you realize the entire basis for your career was a mistake? but that shows how, that shows what people thought at the time and how they regarded this. And yeah, a lot of that, you know, a lot of the polarization and the anger, it just takes different channels than it took different channels then than it does now. But there's really, I think people exaggerate the extent to which today is somehow worse than it was 30 years, you know, 40 years ago.
Great. Roger, if you're back, I want to give you a chance to ask a question.
Yeah, I don't really have a question so much. I just really appreciate hearing Rob's take on this. When I look at what's happening on the border of Ukraine and Russia, I look at the map that we could see from like before 1990 or back from 1990 and looking at it today from what we see as NATO countries now versus what say was the Warsaw Pact back in those days. And you know, with the Balkanization, we see countries like Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania joining with Western powers. And I think there's two lessons to be learned here, is that once we let somebody into NATO, the Russians play a little differently with them. And then the other thing is that when we allow the Russians to encroach on the borders and create border disputes, then they're not allowed to be, even considered to join NATO. And so we have a lot to think about here. I do think though that it's reasonable to consider the Russian position of wanting to have barriers between the West. But I think what the rest of the world should be looking at, specifically, other NATO countries, specifically in Western Europe, is why did the rest of these countries want to join NATO in the first place? What is it that's so bad about the Russians, and dealing with them? And then Russia needs to understand that, you know, the West is not a threat to them should they not want to expand their borders. And so the real question is does Putin, could Putin find ways to look like a strong man, because that's really the way that he stays in power, without expansion? And I don't know if the answer to that is yes, because as pointed out earlier, their economy is tiny. You mentioned, being just not much bigger than Denmark. I think it's somewhere between Denmark and Italy in terms of size of economies. And that's the thing that we have to consider, is that you have a country that was once great in terms of their the way that they thought of themselves, and they've diminished in that power. And in order to be able to stay relevant, they have to kind of stir things up from time to time. And I think that ultimately what we have to be careful about is ceding any real ground here. We don't have what it takes right now to stop them from doing anything in Ukraine. But rather than negotiating away our strength, what I hope we don't do is say, hey, let's avoid a crisis in Ukraine. And in return, what we'll do is we'll take NATO troops out of NATO countries. Yeah. If I were NATO, I would be bolstering our forces everywhere: Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, and making sure that the red line is that, hey, if you are an ally, with us and you've joined a strategic alliance with us, you can count on us. And maybe that will that will encourage the Russians to think twice moving forward. But I have a feeling what's going to happen is we'll avoid a major crisis there, but we'll create a bigger one by pulling back. And I don't think that kind of weakness is going to be the right way to handle this.
Yeah, I just recorded two podcasts. One was posted yesterday at Symposium, which is one of my publications, symposium.substack.com. Got to put in the plug. But it was published yesterday with an objectivist who's from Belarus, who's now in Ukraine. And he was actually very upset with the Americans for sort of pumping up the fear of a war, because he says he thought that basically that the Ukrainian perspective on this is the Americans are pumping up the possibility of a Russian invasion in order to get the Ukrainians to give up some concessions to the Russians. And so that's, and it's not just concessions about who will allow into NATO and NATO expansion and all that sort of thing, but it was about, getting the Ukrainians to make concessions as well. And if we get out of this, and it looks like we are going to get out of this without making any concessions to Putin, I think that's going to be a really good outcome. I saw some indications today that might be the way direction is going, that he's realized that we've called this bluff and he's now de-escalating. But the other podcast is with Shay Kateri, he came from Iran during the Green Revolution there, and he's now a writer about foreign policy here in America, and he talked about how in addition to all the other reasons that want to cause dictatorships to be aggressive, like, for example, one of the most active nations in leadership against the Russians has been Britain. And the reason is because the Russians just pulled off this whole series of assassinations of people they see as enemies of Russia, assassinations in the UK, assassinations carried out with nerve gas and polonium on British soil. And so the British are really kind of, they're ticked off about this. They're much more focused on the Russian threat than we are because of that. And that shows how, their dictatorship in Russia tends to spill out. They want to exercise control over everybody outside of Russia too. But in addition to that, what Shay pointed out from his Iranian perspective, he says there are three countries on the earth that are extra belligerent because they think of themselves as part of their national self-image to think of themselves as being empires. He says that's China, Russia, and Iran. And that's, you think about Iranian behavior, it's like they have all the elements of religious fanaticism and dictatorship that cause them to want to export trouble. But on top of that, they have this national sense going back thousands of years that they should be the center of a great empire. And so that's what feeds a lot of this. And it's the reason why, when you have these sort of evil empires that are growing up, that it makes them extra dangerous. I think is their own consciousness of the gap between these sort of insanely ambitious dreams of empire and their actual capability. And they try to fill in that gap by militarizing their society or by finding other ways that they can cause chaos. So chaos and discord and, fund in the case of Iran, funding terrorists or getting nuclear weapons. They look for ways to fill in the gaps between their actual capability and these insane, grandiose dreams of empire that they have. And that's what creates this extra danger. And I think I think that this whole thing in Ukraine will be positive if it's a wake-up call to us and also a wake-up call to our NATO allies that, hey, Sweden, your five tanks aren't enough. You need to have more. A wake-up to our allies to take this seriously and to come up with a plan. And like I said, just simply to focus on it and have objectives and a plan for how we're going to reach those objectives, as opposed to the drift that we're in, the Etch-a-Sketch-a-Sand sense of drift that we're in right now.
That's great. Well, thank you for sharing this with us, Rob. We'll see if this is a story to come up again. And I just wanted to mention briefly, tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern, Atlas Society founder David Kelly and senior scholar Richard Salzman will have a discussion on current events. That'll be across all the channels. And then Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, I'll be back here on Clubhouse hosting Richard Salzman with a pretty controversial topic: is objectivism a religion? Those could have been construed as fighting words in the early days of the movement. So I look forward to that. But again, Rob, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts today. On behalf of the Atlas Society, thanks to everyone for participating, and we hope to see you next time.
Thanks, Scott, and thanks, everyone else.
Thanks.